Part 2. Complication. I can add colours to the chameleon, change shapes with Proteus for advantages, and set the murderous Machiavel to school. King Henry VI, Part 3. Chapter 4. At the Court of Kappa Barsavi. 1.
19,000, said Bug. 920. That's all of it. Can I please kill myself now?
What? I'd have thought you'd be enthusiastic about helping us tally the loot, Bug. Jean sat cross-legged in the middle of the dining area in the glass cellar beneath the house of Perelandro. The table and chairs had been moved away to make room for a vast quantity of gold coins, stacked into little glittering mounds that circled Jean and Bug, nearly walling them in completely.
You didn't tell me you'd be hauling it home in tirins.
Well, white iron is dear. Nobody's going to hand out 5,000 crowns in it, and nobody's going to be dumb enough to carry it around like that. Moraggio's makes all of its big payouts in tirins. There was a rattling noise from the entrance passage to the cellar. Then Locke appeared around the corner, dressed as Lucas Fairwhite. He whipped his false optics off, loosened his cravats and shrugged out of his wool coat, letting it fall unceremoniously to the floor. His face was flushed, and he was waving a piece of folded parchment affixed with a blue wax seal.
7,500 more, my boys!
I told him we'd found 4 likely galleons, but that we were already having cash flow problems. Bribes to be paid, crews to be called back and sobered up, officers to be placated, other cargo shippers to be chased off. And he just handed it right over, smiling all the while. Gods, I should have thought this scam up 5 years ago. We don't even have to bother setting up fake ships and paperwork and so forth, because Salvara knows the Fairwhite part of the game is a lie. There's nothing for us to do except relax and count the money.
If it's so relaxing, why don't you count it then?
Bug jumped to his feet and leaned backward until his back and his neck made a series of little popping noises.
I'd be happy to, Bug.
Locke took a bottle of red wine out of a wooden cupboard and poured himself half a glass, then watered it from a brass pitcher of lukewarm rainwater until it was a soft pink.
And tomorrow you can play Lucas Fairwhite. I'm sure Don Salvara would never notice any difference. Is it all here?
5,000 crowns delivered as 20,000 tyrins, said Jean. Less 80 for clerking fees and guards and a rented dray to haul it from Moraggio's. The gentleman bastards used a simple substitution scheme for hauling large quantities of valuables to their hideout at the house of Perelandro. At a series of quick stops, strong boxes of coins would vanish from one wagon and barrels marked as common food or drink would roll off on another. Even a decrepit little temple needed a steady infusion of basic supplies.
Well, said Locke, let me get rid of poor Master Fairwhite's clothes and I'll give you a hand dumping it all in the vault.
There were actually 3 vaults tucked away at the rear of the cellar, behind the sleeping quarters. 2 of them were wide elderglass-coated shafts that went down about 10 feet. Their original purpose was unknown. With simple wooden doors mounted on hinges set atop them, they resembled nothing so much as miniature grain storage towers sunk into the earth and filled to a substantial depth with coins of every sort. Silver and gold in large quantities went into the vaults. Narrow wooden shelves around the periphery of the vault room held small bags or piles of more readily useful currency. There were cheap purses of copper barons, fine leather wallets with tight rolls of silver solons, and small bowls of clipped half-copper bits, all of them set out for the rapid taking for any scam or need one of the gang might face. There were even little stacks of foreign coinage, marks from the Kingdom of the 7 Marrows, solari from Tal Verar, and so forth. Even back in the days of Father Chains, there had been no locks on these vaults or on the room that held them. This was not merely because the gentlemen bastards trusted one another, and they did, nor because the existence of their luxurious cellar was a closely guarded secret, and it certainly was. The primary reason was one of practicality. Not one of them, Carlo or Galdo or Locke or Jean or Bug had anything they could conceivably do with their steadily growing pile of precious metal. Outside of Kappa Barsavi, they had to be the wealthiest thieves in Camor. The little parchment ledger set aside on one of the shelves would list more than 43,000 full crowns when Don Salvar's second note was turned into cold coin. They were as wealthy as the man they were currently robbing, and far wealthier than many of his peers. Yet, so far as anyone knew, the gentleman bastards were an unassuming gang of ordinary sneak thieves, competent and discreet enough, steady earners, but hardly shooting stars. They could live comfortably for 10 crowns apiece each year, and to spend much more than that would invite the most unwelcome scrutiny imaginable from every authority in Camor, legal or otherwise. In 4 years, they'd brought off 3 huge scores and were currently working on their 4th. For 4 years, the vast majority of the money had simply been counted and thrown down into the darkness of the vaults. The truth was, chains had trained them superbly for the task of relieving Camor's nobility of the burden of some of its accumulated wealth, but had perhaps neglected to discuss the possible uses of the sums involved. Other than financing further theft, the gentleman bastards really had no idea what they were eventually going to do with it all. Their tithe to Kappa Barsavi averaged about 1 crown a week. 2. "Rejoice!" cried Carlo as he appeared in the kitchen, just as Locke and Jean were moving the dining table back to its customary position. "The Sansa brothers are returned!" "I do wonder," said Jean, "if that particular combination of words has ever been uttered by anyone before now."
"Only in the chambers of unattached young ladies across the city," said Galdo, as he set a small burlap sack down on the table.
Locke shook it open and perused the contents. A few lockets set with semi-precious stones, a set of moderately well-crafted silver forks and knives, and an assortment of rings ranging from cheap engraved copper to one made of threaded gold and platinum, set with flecks of obsidian and diamond.
"Oh, very nice," said Locke. "Very likely. Jean, would you pick out a few more bits from the bullshit box and get me 20 solons, right?"
20's good and proper." While Locke gestured for Carlo and Galdo to help him set chairs back in place around the dining table, Jean walked back to the vault room, where there was a tall, narrow wooden chest tucked against the left-hand wall. He threw back the lid on its creaky hinges and began rummaging inside, a thoughtful expression on his face. The bullshit box was filled to a depth of about 2 feet with a glittering pile of jewellery, knick-knacks, household items, and decorative gewgaws. There were crystal statues, mirrors in carved ivory frames, necklaces and rings, candle holders in 5 kinds of precious metal. There were even a few bottles of drugs and alchemical draughts wrapped in felt to cushion them and marked with little paper labels. Since the gentlemen bastards could hardly tell the Kappa about the true nature of their operations, and since they had neither the time nor the inclination to actually break into houses and clamber down chimneys, the bullshit box was one of the pillars of their ongoing deception. They topped it off once or twice a year, going on buying sprees in the pawn shops and markets off Talisham or Ashmere, where they could get whatever they needed openly. They supplemented it only slightly and carefully with goods picked up in Camor, usually things stolen on a whim by the Sansas or secured by Bug as part of his continuing education. Jean selected a pair of silver wine goblets, a pair of gold-framed optics inside a fine leather case, and one of the little wrapped bottles. Clutching all of this carefully in one hand, he then counted 20 small silver coins off a shelf, kicked the bullshit box shut, and hurried back out to the dining room. Bug had rejoined the group and was ostentatiously walking a solon across the knuckles of his right hand. He'd mastered the trick only weeks previously, after long months of watching the Sansas, who could each do both hands at once, reversing directions in perfect unison.
"Let us say," said Jean, "that we have had a somewhat slothful week.
Nobody expects much from second-story men when the nights are wet like this anyway. We might look out of place if we haul in too much. Surely His Honour will understand.
Of course, said Locke. Quite a reasonable thought.
He reached out and took the felt-wrapped bottle for close examination. His handwritten label identified it as sugared milk of opium, a rich lady's vice made from dried jeremite poppies. He removed the label and the felt, then tucked the faceted glass bottle with its brass stopper into the burlap sack. The rest of the loot followed.
Right. Now, is there any speck of Lucas Fairwhite still clinging to me? Any make-up or mummery?
He stuck out his arms and twirled several times. Jean and the Sansas assured him that he was entirely Locke Lamora for the moment.
Well then, if we're all our proper selves, let's go pay our taxes.
Locke lifted the sack of stolen items and tossed it casually to Bug. The boy yelped, dropping his coin, and caught the sack with a muffled clatter of shaken metal.
Good for my moral education, I suppose.
No, said Locke.
This time I really am just being a lazy old bastard. At least you won't have to work the barge pole.
3. It was the third hour of the afternoon when they set out from the Temple of Perelandro via their assorted escape tunnels and side entrances. A warm drizzle was falling from the sky, which was neatly divided as though by some ruler and stylus of the gods. Low dark clouds filled the north, while the sun was just starting downward in the bright clear southwest. The pleasant scent of fresh rain on hot stone welled up everywhere, briefly washing the usual city miasmas from the air. The gentlemen bastards gathered once again at the southwestern docks of the temple district, where they hailed a gondola for hire. The boat was long and shallow and heavily weathered, with a freshly killed rat lashed to the bow spar just beneath a small wooden idol of Iono. This was allegedly a peerless ward against capsizing and other misfortunes. The pole man perched at the stern like a parrot in his red and orange striped cotton jacket, protected from the rain by a broad-brimmed straw hat that drooped out past his skinny shoulders. He turned out to be a canal jumper and purse cutter of their acquaintance, Nervous Vitale Vento of the Grey Faces gang. Vitale rigged a mildewy leather umbrella to keep some of the drizzle off his passengers, and then began to pole them smoothly east between the high stone banks of the temple district and the overgrown lushness of the Mara Camorazza. The Mara had once been a garden maze for a rich governor of the Therin throne era. Now it was largely abandoned by the city watch and haunted by cutpurses. The only reason honest folk even ventured into its dangerous green passages was that it was the heart of a network of footbridges connecting 8 other islands. Jean settled in to read from a very small volume of verse he'd tucked into his belt, while Bug continued practicing his coin manipulation, albeit with a copper piece that would look much less incongruous in public. Locke and the Sansa brothers talked shop with Vitale, whose job, in part, was to mark particularly lightly guarded or heavily loaded cargo barges for the attention of his fellows. On several occasions, he made hand signals to concealed watchers on shore, while the gentlemen bastards politely pretended not to notice. They drew close to Shades Hill. Even by day, those heights were steeped in gloom. By chance, the rain stiffened, and the old kingdom of tombs grew blurred behind a haze of mist. Vitale swung the boat to the right. Soon he was pushing them southward between Shades Hill and the Narrows, aided by the current of the seaward-flowing canal, now alive with the spreading ripples of raindrops. Traffic grew steadily thinner and less reputable on the canal as they sped south. They were passing from the open rule of the Duke of Camor to the private dominion of Capa Barsavi. On the left, the forges of the coal-smoke district were sending up columns of blackness, mushrooming and thinning out beneath the press of the rain. The Duke's wind would push it all down over Ashfall, the most ill-looking island in the city, where gangs and squatters contended for space in the mouldering, smoke-darkened villas of an opulent age, now centuries past. A northbound barge moved past on their left, wafting forth the stench of old shit and new death. What looked to be an entire team of dead horses was lying in the barge, attended by half a dozen knackers. Some were slicing at the corpses with arm-length serrated blades, while others were frantically unrolling and adjusting blood-stained tarps beneath the rain. No Camorri could have asked for a more appropriate match for the sight and stink of the cauldron. If the dregs were poverty-racked, the snare disreputable, the Mara Camorrazza openly dangerous, and Ashfall dirty and falling apart, the cauldron was all of these things with a compound interest of human desperation. It smelled something like a keg of bad beer overturned in a mortician's storage room on a hot summer day. Most of this district's dead never made it as far as the pauper's holes dug by convicts on the hills of the Beggar's Barrow. They were tipped into canals or simply burned. No yellow jackets had dared enter the cauldron save in platoons even before the secret peace. No temples had been maintained here for 50 years or more. Barsavi's least sophisticated and restrained gangs ruled the cauldron's blocks. Brawlers' taverns and gays' dens and itinerant gambling circles were packed wall to wall with families crammed into rat holes. It was commonly held that 1 in 3 of Camorra's right people were crammed into the cauldron, 1,000 wasters and cutthroats bickering endlessly and terrorizing their neighbors, accomplishing nothing and going nowhere. Locke had come out of catchfire, Jean from the comfortable north corner. Carlo and Galdo had been dregs boys prior to their stay in Shades Hill. Only Bug had come out of the cauldron, and he had never once spoken of it, not in the 4 years he'd been a gentleman bastard. He was staring at it now, at the sagging docks and layered tenements, at the clothes flapping on wash lines, soaking up water. The streets were brown with the unhealthy haze of sodden cook fires. Its flood walls were crumbling, its elderglass mostly buried in grime and piles of stone. Bug's coin had ceased to flow across his knuckles and stood still on the back of his left hand. A few minutes later, Locke was privately relieved to slip past the heart of the cauldron and reach the high, thin breakwater that marked the eastern edge of the wooden waste. Camorra's maritime graveyard seemed positively cheerful by comparison once the boat had put the cauldron to its stern. A graveyard it was. A wide, sheltered bay, larger than the shifting market, filled with the bobbing, undulating wrecks of hundreds of ships and boats. They floated hull up and hull down, anchored as well as drifting freely, some merely rotting while others were torn open from collisions or catapult stones. A layer of smaller wooden debris floated on the water between the wrecks like scum on cold soup, ebbing and resurging with the tide. When false light fell, this junk would sometimes ripple with the unseen passage of creatures drawn in from Camorra Bay, for while tall iron gates shuttered every major canal against intrusion, the wooden waste was open to the sea on its south side. At the heart of the waste floated a fat, dismasted hulk, 60 yards long and nearly half as wide, anchored firmly in place by chains leading down into the water, two at the bow and two at the stern. Camorra had never built anything so heavy and ungainly. That vessel was one of the more optimistic products of the arsenals of distant Tal Vahrar, just as chains had told Locke many years before. Wide silk awnings now covered its high, flat castle decks. Beneath those canopies parties could be thrown that rivaled the pleasure pavilions of Jerem for their decadence. But at the moment the decks were clear of everything but the cloaked shapes of armed men, peering out through the rain. Locke could see at least a dozen of them, standing in groups of two or three with longbows and crossbows at hand. There was human movement here and there throughout the waste. Some of the less damaged vessels housed families of squatters, and some of them were being openly used as observation points by more teams of hard-looking men. Vitali navigated through the twisting channels between larger wrecks, carefully making obvious hand gestures at the men on guard whenever the gondola passed them.
"Grey King got another one last night," he muttered, straining against his pole.
Lots of twitchy boys with big murder pieces keeping an eye on us right now, that's for damn sure.
Another one?
Carlo narrowed his eyes.
We hadn't heard yet. Who got it?
Tall Tesso from the Four Crowns. They found him up in Rustwater, nailed to the wall of an old shop, balls cut off. His blood ran out, is what it looked like.
Locke and Jean exchanged a glance, and Nervous Vitale grunted.
Acquainted, were you?
After a fashion, said Locke, and some time ago. Locke pondered. Tesso was, had been, Garista of the Four Crowns, one of Barsavi's big earners, and a close friend of the Kappa's younger son, Pacero. Nobody in Camor should have been able to touch him, save only Barsavi and the spider. Yet that damned invisible lunatic calling himself the Grey King had touched him in no uncertain terms.
That's six, said Jean, isn't it?
Seven, said Locke. There haven't been this many dead gods damned Garistas since you and I were 5 years old.
Heh, said Vitale. And to think I once envied you, Lamora, even with this tiny little gang of yours.
Locke glared at him, willing the puzzle to come together in his head, and not quite succeeding. Seven gang leaders in 2 months, all of them given the distance, but otherwise having little in common. Locke had long taken comfort in his own lack of importance to the Kappa's affairs, but now he began to wonder. Might he be on someone's list? Did he have some unguessed value to Barsavi that the Grey King might want to end with a crossbow bolt? How many others were between him and that bolt?
Damn, said Jean, as if things needed to get more complicated.
Maybe we should take care of current business.
Galdo had shifted against the side of the gondola and was looking around as he spoke.
And then maybe we should get lost for a while. See Talvara or Talisham, or at least get you out, Locke.
Nonsense. Locke spat over the side of the boat. Sorry, Galdo. I know it seems like wisdom, but do the sums. The Kappa would never forgive our running out in his desperate hour. He'd rescind the distance and put us under the thumb of the most graceless, pig-hearted motherfucker he could find. We can't run as long as he stays. Hell, Nazca would break my knees with a mallet before anyone else did anything.
You have my sympathy, boys.
Vitale shifted his pole from hand to hand, using precise shoves to warp the gondola around a chunk of debris too large to ignore.
Canal work ain't easy, but at least nobody wants me dead for more than the usual reasons. Did you want me to leave you at the grave or at the quay?
We need to see Haza, said Locke.
Oh, he's sure to be in a rare mood today.
Vitale began poling hard for the northern edge of the waste, where a few stone docks jutted out before a row of shops and rooming houses.
The key it is, then.
4. The pawn shop of No Hope Haza was one of the major landmarks of the reign of Kappa Barsavi. While there were many shops that paid slightly more, and a great many with less surly proprietors, there were no others located a bare stone's throw from the very seat of the Kappa's power. Right people, cashing in their creatively acquired loot with Haza, could be sure that their presence would be reported to Barsavi. It never hurt to reinforce the impression that one was an active, responsible thief.
Oh, of course,
said the old Vardran as Jean held the barred and armoured door open for the other four gentlemen bastards.
Figures only the least important Garistas would dare show their faces on a day like this. Come in, my ill-looking sons of Camori bitches. Rub your oily therin fingers on my lovely merchandise. Drip water on my beautiful floors.
Haza's shop was always closed up like a coffin, rain or shine. Dusty canvas sheets were drawn over the narrow, barred windows, and the place smelled of silver polish, mildew, stale incense, and old sweat. Haza himself was a snow-skinned old man with wide, watery eyes, Every seam and wrinkle on his face seemed to be steadily sliding toward the ground, as though he'd been shaped by a slightly drunk god who'd pressed the mortal clay just a little too far down. No Hope had earned his moniker with his firm policy against extending credit or loaning coin. Carlo had once remarked that if he ever took an arrow in the skull, he'd sit around and wait for it to fall out on its own before he'd pay a physicker for so much as a gauze scrap. In the right-hand corner of the shop, a burly, bored-looking young man with cheap brass on all of his fingers and greasy ringlets hanging in his eyes shifted his position on the tall wooden stool he occupied. An iron-studded club swung from a loop at his belt, and he nodded slowly at the visitors, unsmiling, as though they were too stupid to comprehend his function.
"Loch Lamora," said Haza. "Perfume bottles and ladies' small clothes, tableware and drinking goblets, scraped and dented metal I can't sell to anyone with any class ever again. You breakers and second-story boys think you're so clever. You'd steal shit from a dog's arsehole if you had the right sort of bag to bring it home with you."
"Funny you should say that, Haza, because this bag here..." Locke plucked the burlap sack from Bug's hands and held it up. "Happens to contain..."
"Something other than dog shit. I can hear it jingling. Give over and let's see if you accidentally brought in anything worth buying."
Haza's nostrils flared as he opened the sack and slid it along a leather pad atop his shop counter, gently spilling the contents. The appraisal of stolen goods seemed to be the only form of sensual gratification left to the old man, and he dove into the task with enthusiasm, long crooked fingers wiggling.
"Crap!"
He lifted the three lockets secured by Carlo and Galdo.
"Fucking alchemical paste and river agates. Not fit for goat feed. 2 coppers apiece."
"Harsh," said Locke.
"Fair," said Haza. "Yes or no?"
7 coppers for all three."
2 times 3 is 6, said Haza. "Say yes or go twist a shark's balls for all I care."
"I suppose I'll say yes then." Haza perused the silver goblets Jean had selected from the bullshit box.
"Dented, of course. You idiots never see a pretty silver thing you don't want to stuff inside a scratchy fucking bag. I suppose I can polish them and send them upriver. 1 solon, 3 coppers apiece.
1 solon, 4 per, said Locke.
3 solons, 1 copper total.
Fine.
And this...
Haza picked up the bottle of opium milk, unscrewed the cap, sniffed, grunted to himself, and sealed the vial once again.
"Worth more than your life, but I can't hardly do much with it. Fussy bitches like to make their own or get an alchemist to do it for them. They never buy pre-mixed from strangers. Maybe I can pass it off on some poor fucker that needs a vacation from grapes or gays. 3 solons, 3 barons.
4 solons, 2.
The gods wouldn't get 4 and 2 from me. Morgante himself with a flaming sword and 10 naked virgins yanking at my breeches might get 4 solons, 1. You get 3 and 4, and that's final."
"Fine, and only because we're in a hurry." Haza was keeping a running total with a goose quill and a scrap of parchment. He ran his fingers over the small pile of cheap rings from Carlo and Galdo and laughed.
"You can't be serious. This crap is as welcome as a pile of 7 dog cocks.
"Oh, come on.
I could sell the dog cocks to the knackers at least."
Haza flung the brass and copper rings at the gentleman bastards one by one.
"I'm serious! Don't bring that crap around! I've got boxes on boxes of the fucking things I won't sell this side of death!"
He came to the threaded gold and platinum ring with the diamond and obsidian chips.
This one signifies, at least, 5 solons flat. Gold's real, but the platinum's cheap Ferrari shit, genuine as a glass eye. And I crap bigger diamonds 5 or 6 times weekly.
7 and 3, said Locke. I went to pains to get that particular piece.
I have to pay extra because your arse and your brain switched places at birth? I think not. If that were the case, I'd have heard about it before. Take your 5 and consider yourself lucky.
I can assure you, Hauser, that nobody who comes to this shop considers himself particularly... And so it went. The apparently summary judgment, the two-way flow of abuse, the grudging assent from Locke, and the gnashing of the old man's remaining teeth when he took each item and set it down behind the counter. In short order, Hauser was sweeping the last few things he had no interest in back into the burlap sack.
Well, sweetmeats, looks as though we're quits at 16 solons 5. I suppose it beats driving a shit wagon, doesn't it?
Or running a pawn shop, yes, said Locke.
Very amusing,
cried the old man as he counted out 16 tarnished silver coins and 5 smaller copper discs.
I give you the legendary lost treasure of Camor. Grab your things and fuck off until next week. Assuming the Grey King doesn't get you first.
5. The rain had faded back to a drizzle when they emerged from Hauser's shop, giggling to themselves. Chains used to claim that there's no freedom quite like the freedom of being constantly underestimated, said Locke.
Gods, yes.
Carlo rolled his eyes and stuck out his tongue.
If we were any freer, we'd float away into the sky and fly like the birds.
From the northern edge of the wooden waste, a long, high wooden bridge, wide enough for 2 people, ran straight out to the Kappa's waterbound fortress. There were 4 men on guard at the shore, standing around in the open with weapons clearly visible under their lightweight oil cloaks. Locke surmised there would be at least as many concealed nearby within easy crossbow shot. He made the month's proper hand signs as he approached with his gang behind him. Everyone here knew each other, but the formalities were non-negotiable, especially at a time like this.
Hello, Lamora.
The oldest man in the guard detail, a wiry old fellow with faded shark tattoos running up his neck and his cheeks all the way to his temples, reached out. They grasped left forearms.
Heard about Tesso?
Yeah. Hello yourself, Burnell. One of the grey faces told us on the way down.
So it's true? Nailed up, balls, the whole bit?
Balls, the whole bit. You can imagine how the boss feels about it. Speaking of which, Nazca left orders. Just this morning. Next time you came by, she wanted to see you. Said not to let you pay your taxes until she'd had a word. You are here for taxes, right?
Locke shook a little grey purse, Jean's 20 solons plus Harza's 16 and change.
Here to do our civic duty, indeed.
Good. Not passing many folks for any other reason. Look, I know you've got the distance and Nazca's a friend and all, but maybe you want to take it real easy today, right? Lots of peasant around, obvious and not so obvious, tight as it's ever been. Kappa's making inquiries with some of the full crowns right now, as regards their whereabouts last night.
Inquiries?
In the grand old fashion. So mind your manners and don't make any sudden moves, right?
Savvy, said Locke. Thanks for the warning.
No trouble. Crossbow bolts cost money. Shame to waste them on the likes of you.
Burnell waved them through, and they strolled down the wooden walkway, which was about 100 yards long. It led to the stern of the wide, motionless vessel, where the timbers of the outer hull had been cut away and replaced with a pair of iron-reinforced witchwood doors. Another pair of guards stood here, one male and one female, the dark circles under their eyes plainly evident. The woman knocked four times at their approach, and the doors swung inward just a few seconds later. Stifling a yawn, the female guard leaned back against the outer wall and pulled the hood of her oil cloak up over her head. The dark clouds were sweeping in from the north, and the heat of the sun was starting to fade. The reception hall of the floating grave was nearly four times Locke's height, as the cramped horizontal decks of the old galleon had been torn out long ago, save for the upper castle and waste decks, which now served as roofs. The floor and walls were coffee-coloured hardwood. The bulkheads were hung with black and red tapestries on which shark's teeth border patterns were embroidered in gold and silver thread. A half-dozen bravos stood facing the gentleman bastards, crossbows levelled. These men and women wore leather bracers and leather doublets over silk tunics reinforced with light metal bands. Their necks were girded with stiff leather collars. A more genteel foyer would have been decorated with glow lamps and flower arrangements. The walls of this one held wicker baskets of crossbow quarrels and racks of spare blades.
"Ease up," said a young woman standing behind the gaggle of guards. "I know they're suspicious as hell, but I don't see a Grey King among 'em."
She wore men's breeches and a loose black silk blouse with billowing sleeves under a ribbed leather dueling harness that looked to have seen more use than storage. Her iron-shod boots, a taste she had never lost, clicked against the floor as she stepped between the sentries. Her welcoming smile didn't quite reach all the way to her eyes, which darted nervously behind the lenses of her plain, black-rimmed optics.
"My apologies for the reception, loves," said Nazca Barsavi, addressing all the bastards but placing a hand on Locke's left shoulder. She was a full 2 inches taller than he was. "And I know it's cramped in here, but I need the four of you to wait around. Garistas only. Papa's in a mood."
There was a muffled scream from behind the doors that led to the inner chambers of the floating grave, followed by the faint murmur of raised voices, shouts, cursing, another scream. Nazca rubbed her temples, pushed back a few stray curls of her black hair, and sighed.
"He's making a vigorous case for full disclosure from some of the full crowns. He's got sage kindness in there with him."
13 gods, said Carlo. "We're happy to wait."
"Indeed."
Galdo reached into his coat and pulled out a slightly soggy deck of playing cards.
"We can certainly keep ourselves entertained out here, indefinitely if need be."
At the sight of a Sansa brother offering cards, every guard in the room took a step back. Some of them visibly struggled with the idea of raising their crossbows again.
"Oh, not you bastards, too," said Galdo. "Look, those stories are all bullshit. Everyone else at that table was just having a very unlucky night."
Past the wide, heavy doors was a short passage, unguarded and empty. Nazca slid the foyer doors closed behind herself and Locke, then turned to him. She reached and slicked back his wet hair. The corners of her mouth were turned down.
"Hello, Pezon. I see you haven't been eating."
"I eat regular meals."
"You should try eating for quantity as well as consistency. I believe I once mentioned that you looked like a skeleton."
"And I believe I'd never before seen a 7-year-old girl pushy drunk in public."
"Well, perhaps I was pushy drunk then, but today I'm just pushy.
Papa's in a bad way, Locke.
I wanted to see you before you saw him. He has some things he wishes to discuss with you. I want you to know that whatever he asks, I don't want you to, for my sake, well, please just agree. Please him, do you understand?"
"No garista who loves life has ever tried to do otherwise. You think I'm inclined to walk in on a day like today and deliberately twist his breeches?
If your father says bark like a dog, I say, what breed, Your Honour?
I know. Forgive me. But my point is this. He's not himself. He's afraid now, Locke. Absolutely, genuinely afraid. He was morose when Mother died, but damn, now he's crying out in his sleep, taking wine and laudanum every day to keep his temper in check. Used to be I was the only one not allowed to leave the grave, but now he wants Anjace and Panchero to stay here too. 50 guards on duty at all times. The Duke's life is more carefree. Papa and my brothers were up shouting about it all night.
Well, look, I'm sorry, but I don't think I can help you with that. But just what is it you think he's going to ask me?
Nazca stared at him, mouth half open as though she were preparing to speak. Then she seemed to think better of it, and her lips compressed back into a frown.
Damn it, Nazca! I'd jump in the bay to try to blackjack a shark if you wanted, really! But you'd have to tell me how big it was and how hungry it was first. Savvy?
Yes. Look, I just... It'll be less awkward if he does it himself. Just remember what I said. Hear him. Please him. And you and I can sort things out later. If we get a later.
What do you mean, if we get a later? Nazca, you're worrying me.
This is it, Locke. This is the bad one. The Grey King is finally getting to Papa. Tesso had 60 knives, any 10 of which were with him all the time. Tesso was deep into Papa's good graces. There were big plans for him in the near future, but Papa's had things his way for so long, I can't rightly say if he knows what to do about this. So he just wants to fold everything up and hide us here. Siege mentality.
Locke sighed. I can't say that what he's done so far is imprudent, Nazca. He's...
Papa's mad. If he thinks he can just keep us all here, locked up in this fortress forever. He used to be at the last mistake half the nights of the week. He used to walk the docks, walk the Mara, walk the Narrows any time he pleased. He used to throw out coppers at the procession of the Shades. The Duke of Camor can lock himself in his privy and rule legitimately. The Cupper of Camor cannot. He needs to be seen.
And risk assassination by the Grey King?
Look, I've been stuck inside this fucking wooden tub for 2 months, and I tell you, we're no safer here than we would be bathing naked at the dirtiest fountain in the darkest courtyard in the cauldron.
Nazca had folded her arms beneath her breast so tightly that her leather cuirass creaked.
Who is this Grey King? Where is he? Who are his men? We don't have a single idea. And yet this man reaches out and kills our people at leisure, however he sees fit. Something is wrong. He has resources we don't understand.
He's clever and he's lucky. Neither of those things lasts forever, trust me.
Not just clever and lucky, Locke. I agree there are limits to both. So what does he have up his sleeves? What does he know? Or who? If we are not betrayed, then it must be that we are overmatched. And I am reasonably certain that we are not yet betrayed.
Not yet?
Don't play stupid with me, Locke. Business could go on after a fashion with Papa and myself cooped up here. But if he won't let Anjace and Panchero out to run the city, the whole regime will go to hell. The Garistas might think it prudent for some of the Barsavis to stay here. They'll think it cowardice for all of us to hide. And they won't just talk behind our backs. They'll actively court another Kappa. Maybe a pack of new Kappas. Or maybe the Grey King.
So naturally your brothers will never let him trap them here.
Depends on how mad and crazy the old man gets. But even if they stay free to roam, that's only the lesser part of the problem solved. We are again overmatched. 3,000 knives at our command, and the ghost still has the twist on us.
What do you suspect? Sorcery?
I suspect everything. They say the Grey King can kill a man with just a touch. They say that blades won't cut him. I suspect the gods themselves, and so my brothers think I'm crazy. When they look at the situation, all they see is a regular war. They think we can just outlast it, lock the old man and the baby sister up, and wait until we know where to hit back. But I don't see that. I see a cat with his paw over a mouse's tail. And if the cat's claws haven't come out yet, it's not because of anything the mouse has done. Don't you get it?
Nazca, I know you're agitated. I'll listen. I'm a stone. You can yell at me all you like.
But what can I do for you? I'm just a thief. I'm your father's littlest thief. If there's a gang smaller than mine, I'll go play cards in a wolf shark's mouth. I need you to start helping me calm Papa down, Locke. I need him back to something resembling his normal self, so I can get him to take my point seriously. That's why I'm asking you to go in there and take pains to please him. Especially please him. Show him a loyal garista who does whatever he's told, the moment he's told. When he starts to lay reasonable plans for the future again, I'll know he's coming back to a state of mind I can deal with.
Interesting, said Locke. And, daunting.
Papa used to say someday I'd appreciate having a gracious man to order around. Believe me, Locke, I do. So, here we are.
At the end of the short passage was another set of heavy wooden doors, nearly identical to the ones that led back to the reception hall. These doors, however, were barred and locked with an elaborate Ferrari clockwork device attached to crossbars of polished iron. A dozen keyholes were visible in the lockbox at the center of the doors. Nazca withdrew two keys that hung on a chain around her neck and briefly put her body between Locke and the doors so he couldn't see the apertures she chose. There was a cascading series of clicks and the noise of machinery within the doors. One by one, the hidden bolts unshot themselves, and the gleaming crossbars slid open until the doors finally cracked open in the middle. Another scream, loud and vivid, without the closed door to muffle it, sounded from the room beyond.
"It's worse than it sounds," said Nazca.
"I know what sage does for your father, Nazca."
"Knowing's one thing. Usually sage just does one or two at a time. Papa's got the bastard working wholesale today."
6.
"I've made it clear that I don't enjoy this," said Kappa Barsavi. "So why do you force me to persist?"
The dark-haired young man was secured to a wooden rack. He hung upside down with metal shackles around his legs, with arms tied downward at their maximum extension. The copper's heavy fist slammed into the prisoner's side just beneath his armpit. The sound was like a hammer slapping meat. Droplets of sweat flew, and the prisoner screamed, writhing against his restraints.
"Why do you insult me like this, Federico?"
Another punch to the same spot, with the heavy old man's first two knuckles cruelly extended.
"Why don't you even have the courtesy to give me a convincing lie?"
Kappa Barsavi lashed Federico's throat with the flat of one hand. The prisoner gasped for breath, snorting wetly as blood and spit and sweat ran down into his nose. The heart of the floating grave was something like an opulent ballroom with curving sides. Warm amber light came from glass globes suspended on silver chains. Stairs ran to overhead galleries, and from these galleries to the silk-canopied deck of the old hulk. A small raised platform against the far wall held the broad wooden chair from which Barsavi usually received visitors. The room was tastefully decorated in a restrained and regal fashion, and today it stank of fear and sweat and soiled breeches. The frame that held Federico folded downward from the ceiling. An entire semicircle of the things could be pulled down at need, for Barsavi occasionally did this sort of business in a volume that rewarded the standardization of procedures. 6 were now empty and spattered with blood. Only 2 still held prisoners. The copper looked up as Locke and Nazca entered. He nodded slightly and gestured for them to wait against the wall. Old Barsavi remained bullish, but he wore his years in plain view. He was rounder and softer now. his three braided grey beards backed by three wobbly chins. Dark circles cupped his eyes, and his cheeks were the unhealthy sort of red that came out of a bottle. Flushed with exertion, he had thrown off his overcoat and was working in his silk undertunic. Standing nearby with folded arms were Andrzej and Pacero Barsavi, Nazca's older brothers. Andrzej was like a miniature version of the Kappa, minus 30 years and 2 beards, while Pacero was more of a kind with Nazca, tall and slender and curly-haired. Both of the brothers wore optics, for whatever eye trouble the old Madame Barsavi had borne had been passed to all three of her surviving children. Leaning against the far wall were two women. They were not slender. Their bare, tanned arms were corded with muscle and crisscrossed with scars, and while they radiated an air of almost feral good health, they were well past the girlishness of early youth. Sherin and Raiza Barangis, identical twins, and the greatest contrarreciala the city of Camor had ever known. Performing only as a pair, they had given the shifting revel almost 100 performances against sharks, devilfish, death lanterns, and other predators of the Iron Sea. For nearly 5 years they had been Kappa Barsavi's personal bodyguards and executioners. Their long, wild manes of smoke-black hair were tied back under nets of silver that jangled with shark's teeth. One tooth, it was said, for every man or woman the Barangius twins had killed in Barsavi's service. Last, but certainly not least alarming in this exclusive gathering, was Sage Kindness, a round-headed man of moderate height and middle years. His short-cropped hair was the butter yellow of certain Therin families from the westerly cities of Carthane and Lashane. His eyes always seemed to be wet with emotion, though his expression never changed. He was perhaps the most even-tempered man in Camor. He could pull fingernails with the mellow disinterest of a man polishing boots. Kappa Barsavi was a very capable torturer, but when he found himself stymied, the sage never disappointed him.
"He doesn't know anything!"
The last prisoner, as yet untouched, hollered at the top of his voice as Barsavi slapped Federica around some more.
"Kappa, your honor, please! None of us know anything! Gods, none of us remember!"
Barsavi stalked across the wooden floor and shut the second prisoner up by giving his windpipe a long, cruel squeeze.
"Were the questions addressed to you? Are you eager to get involved in the proceedings? You were quiet enough when I sent your other 6 friends down into the water. Why do you cry for this one?"
"Please,"
the man sobbed, sucking in air as Barsavi lightened his grip just enough to permit speech.
"Please, there's no point. You must believe us, Kappa Barsavi, please. We'd have told you anything you wanted if only we knew. We don't remember. We just don't."
The Kappa silenced him with a vicious cuff across the face. For a moment, the only sound in the room was the frightened sobbing and gasping of the two prisoners.
"I must believe you? I must do nothing, Julien. You give me bullshit and tell me it's steamed beef? So many of you, and you can't even come up with a decent story. A serious attempt to lie would still piss me off, but I could understand it. Instead, you cry that you don't remember. You, the 8 most powerful men in the full crowns, after Tesso himself. His chosen, his friends, his bodyguards, his loyal peasant. And you cry like babies to me about how you don't remember where any of you were last night when Tesso just happened to die."
"But that's just how it is, Kappa Barsavi. Please, it's..."
"I ask you again, were you drinking last night?"
"No, not at all."
"Were you smoking anything, all of you, together?"
"No, nothing like that. Certainly not together."
"Gaze, then? A little something from Jerem's pervert alchemists? A little bliss from a powder?"
"Tesso never permitted..."
"Well, then,
Barsavi drove a fist into Julien's solar plexus, almost casually. While the man gasped in pain, Barsavi turned away and held up his arms with theatrical joviality.
"Since we've eliminated every possible earthly explanation for such dereliction of duty, short of sorcery or divine intervention... Oh, forgive me. You weren't enchanted by the gods themselves, were you? They're hard to miss."
Julien writhed against his bonds, red-faced, shaking his head.
"Please!"
"No gods, then. Didn't think so. I was saying that your little game is boring the hell out of me. Kindness?"
The round-headed man lowered his chin to his chest and stood with his palms out, facing upward, as though he were about to receive a gift.
"I want something creative. If Federico won't talk, let's give Julien one chance to find his tongue."
Federico began screaming before Barsavi had even finished speaking, the high, sobbing wail of the conscious damned. Locke found himself clenching his teeth to keep himself from shaking. So many meetings with slaughter as a backdrop. The gods could be perverse. Sage Kindness moved to a small table to the side of the room, on which there was a pile of small glasses and a heavy cloth sack with a drawstring. Kindness threw several glasses into the sack and began banging it against the table. The sound of breaking, jangling glass wasn't audible beneath Federico's wild hollering, but Locke could imagine it easily enough. After a few moments, Kindness seemed satisfied and walked slowly over to Federico.
Don't, please, no.
With one hand holding the desperate young man's head still, Kindness rapidly drew the bag up over the top of his head, over his face, all the way to Federico's neck, where he cinched the drawstring tight. The bag muffled Federico's screams, which had become high and wordless again. Kindness then began to knead the bag, gently at first, almost tenderly. The torturer's long fingers pushed the jagged contents of the sack up and around Federico's face. Red stains began to appear on the surface of the bag. Kindness manipulated the contents of the sack like a sculptor giving form to his clay. Federico's throat mercifully gave out just then, and for the next few moments the man choked out nothing more than a few hoarse moans. Locke prayed silently that he'd already fled beyond pain to the temporary refuge of madness. Kindness increased the vigor with which he massaged the cloth. He pressed now where Federico's eyes would be, and on the nose and the mouth and the chin. The bag grew wetter and redder until at last Federico's twitching stopped altogether. When Kindness took his hands off the bag, they looked as though he'd been pulping tomatoes. Smiling sadly, he let his red hands drip red trails on the wood, and he walked over to Julien, staring intently, saying nothing.
"Surely," said Kappa Barsavi, "if I've convinced you of anything by this point, it must be the depth of my resolve. Will you not speak?"
"Please, Kappa Barsavi," whispered Julien. "There's no need for this. I have nothing I can tell you. Ask me anything, anything at all. What happened last night is a blank. I don't remember. I would tell you, please, gods, please believe me, I would tell you anything. We are loyal, Pezon, the most loyal you have."
"I sincerely hope not."
Barsavi seemed to come to a decision. He gestured to the Barangius sisters and pointed at Julien. The dark-haired ladies worked quickly and silently, undoing the knots that held him to the wooden frame while leaving the ones that bound him from ankles to neck. They cradled the shivering man effortlessly, one at his shoulders and one at his feet.
"Loyal? Please. We are grown men, Julien. Refusing to tell me the truth of what happened last night is not a loyal act. You've let me down, so I give like for like."
On the far left side of the great hall, a man-sized wooden floor panel had been slid aside. Barely a yard down was the dark surface of the water beneath the grave. The floor around the opening was wet with blood.
"I shall let you down."
Julian screamed one last time as the Barangia sisters heaved him into the opening, head first. He hit the water with a splash and didn't come back up. It was the Kappa's habit to keep something nasty down beneath the grave at all times, constrained there by heavy nets of wire-reinforced rope that surrounded the underside of the galleon like a sieve.
"Kindness, you are dismissed. Boys, when I call you back, you can get some people in here to clean up, but for now go wait on deck. Raiza, Sherin, please go with them."
Moving slowly, Kappa Barsavi walked to his plain, comfortable old chair and settled into it. He was breathing heavily and quivering all the more for his effort not to show it. A brass wine goblet with the capacity of a large soup tureen was set out on the little table beside his chair. The Kappa took a deep draught and seemed to brood over the fumes for a few moments, his eyes closed. At last he came back to life and beckoned for Locke and Nazca to step forward.
"Well, my dear Master Lamora, how much money have you brought me this week?"
7. 36 solons, 5 coppers, Your Honor."
A slender week's work, it seems."
"Yes, with all apologies, Kappa Barsavi. The rain, well, sometimes it's murder on those of us doing second-story work." Barsavi set the goblet down and folded his right hand inside his left, caressing the reddened knuckles.
"You've brought me more, of course. Many times. Better weeks."
Yes.
"There are some that don't, you know. They try to bring me the exact same amount week after week after week, until I finally lose patience and correct them. Do you know what that sort of garista must have, Locke?"
A very boring life."
"Ha! Yes, exactly. How very stable of them to have the exact same income every single week, so they might give me the exact same percentage as a cut, as though I were an infant who would not notice. And then there are garistas such as yourself. I know you bring me the honest percentage, because you're not afraid to walk in here and apologize for having less than last week."
"I, do hope I'm not considered shy about sharing when the balance tilts the other way."
"Not at all."
Barsavi smiled and settled back in his chair. Ominous splashing and muffling banging was coming from beneath the floor in the vicinity of the hatch that Julian had vanished down.
"You are, if anything, the most reliably correct garista in my service, like Ferrari clockwork. You deliver my cut yourself, promptly and without a summons, for 4 years, week in and week out, unfailing since Chains died. Never once did you suggest that anything took precedence over your personal appearance before me, with that bag in your hand."
Kappa Barsavi pointed at the small leather bag Locke held in his left hand, and gestured to Nazca. Her formal role in the Barsavi organization was to act as finicker, or record keeper. She could rattle off the running total of the payments made by any gang in the city, itemized week by week and year by year without error. Locke knew she updated records on parchment for her father's private use, but so far as the Kappa's subjects in general knew, every coin of his fabled treasure was catalogued solely behind her cold and lovely eyes. Locke tossed the leather purse to her, and she plucked it out of the air.
"Never," said Kappa Barsavi, "did you think to send a pezon to do a garista's job?"
"Well, you're most kind, Your Honor. But you made that very easy today, since only garistas are allowed past the door."
"Don't dissemble. You know of what I speak. Nazca, love,
Locke and I must now be alone.
Nazca gave her father a deep nod, then gave a much quicker, shallower one to Locke. She turned and walked back toward the doors to the entrance hall, iron heels echoing on the wood.
I have many garistas, Barsavi said when she was gone, tougher than yourself. Many more popular, many more charming, many with larger and more profitable gangs, but I have very few who are constantly at pains to be so courteous, so careful.
Locke said nothing.
My young man, while I take offense at many things, rest assured that courtesy is not one of them. Come, stand easy. I am not fitting you for a noose.
Sorry, Kappa. It's just, you've been known to begin expressing your displeasure in a very,
roundabout fashion?
Chains told me enough about scholars of the Therin Collegium, said Locke, to understand that their primary habit of speech is the, booby trap.
Ah, yes. When anyone tells you habits die hard, Locke, they're lying. It seems they never die at all.
Barsavi chuckled and sipped from his wine before continuing.
These are alarming times, Locke. This damn Grey King has finally begun to get under my skin. The loss of Tesso is particularly... Well, I had plans for him. Now I am forced to begin bringing other plans forward sooner than intended. Tell me, Pezon, what do you think of Andrzej Sanpacero?
Well, my honest opinion, Your Honor?
Full and honest, Pezon, by my command.
Ah, they're very respected, very good at their jobs. Nobody jokes about them behind their backs. Jean says they really know how to handle themselves in a fight. The Sanzas are nervous about playing fair card games with them, which is saying something.
This I could hear from 24 spies any time I wanted to. This I know. What is your personal opinion of my sons?
Locke swallowed and looked Kappa Barsavi straight in the eyes.
Well, they are worthy of respect. They are good at their jobs, and they must know their business in a fight. They're fairly hard workers, and they're bright enough. But, Your Honor, begging your pardon, they tease Nazca when they should be heeding her warnings and taking her advice. She has the patience and the subtlety that...
Elude them?
You knew what I was going to say, didn't you?
I said you were a careful and considerate garista, Locke. Those are your distinguishing characteristics, though they imply many other qualities. Since the time of your prodigious early cock-ups, you have been the very picture of a careful thief, firmly in control of his own greed. You would be very sensitive to any opposing lack of caution in others. My sons have lived all their lives in a city that fears them because of their last name. They expect deference in an aristocratic fashion. They are incautious, a bit brazen. I need to make arrangements to ensure that they receive good counsel in the months and years to come. I can't live forever, even after I deal with the Grey King.
The jovial certainty that filled Kappa Barsavi's voice when he said this made the hair on the back of Locke's neck stand up. The Kappa was sitting in a fortress he hadn't left in more than 2 months, drinking wine in air still rank with the blood of 8 members of one of his most powerful and loyal gangs. Was Locke speaking to a man with a far-ranging and subtle scheme? Or had Barsavi finally cracked, like window glass in a fire?
I should very much like, said the Kappa, to have you in a position to give Andrzej Sanpacero the counsel they'll require.
Ah, Your Honor, that's extremely... flattering, but I get along well enough with Andrzej Sanpacero, but I'm not exactly what you'd call a close friend. We play some cards every now and then, but let's be honest, I'm not a very important garista.
As I said, even with the Grey King at work in my city, I have many who are tougher than you, more daring than you, more popular. I don't say this to strike a blow, because I've already discussed your own qualities. And it is those qualities they sorely need. Not toughness, daring, or charm, but cold and steady caution. Prudence. You are my most prudent, Garista. You only think of yourself as the least important because you make the least noise. Tell me now, what do you think of Nazca?
Nazca?
Locke was suddenly even warier than before.
She's brilliant, Your Honor.
She can recite conversations we had 10 years ago and get every word right, especially if it embarrasses me. You think I'm prudent? Compared to her, I'm as reckless as a bear in an alchemist's lab.
Yes, said the Kappa. Yes. She should be the next Kappa Barsavi when I'm gone, but that won't happen. It's nothing to do with her being a woman, you know. Her older brothers would simply never stand to have their little sister lording it over them. And I should prefer not to have my children murdering one another for scraps of the legacy I intend to leave them, so I cannot push them aside in her favor. What I can do, and what I must do, is ensure that when the time comes, they will have a voice of sobriety in such a place that they cannot get rid of it. You and Nazca are old friends, yes? I remember the first time you met, so many years ago, when she used to sit on my knee and pretend to order my men around. In all the years since, you have always stopped to see her, always given her kind words, always been her good peasant?
I certainly hope so, Your Honor.
I know you have.
Barsavi took a deep draught from his wine goblet, then set it back down firmly, a magnanimous smile on his round, wrinkled face.
And so I give you my permission to court my daughter.
Let's start wobbling, shall we? Said Locke's knees, but this offer was met by a counter-proposal from his better judgment to simply freeze up and do nothing, like a man treading water who sees a tall black fin coming straight at him.
Oh, he finally said, I didn't expect...
Of course not, said Barsavi, but in this our purposes are complementary. I know you and Nazca have feelings for one another. A union between the two of you would bring you into the Barsavi family. You would become Andrzej Sanpachero's responsibility, and they yours. Don't you see? A brother by bonding would be much harder for them to ignore than even their most powerful Garista.
Barsavi set his left fist inside his right and smiled broadly once again, like a red-faced god dispensing benevolence from a celestial throne. Locke took a deep breath. There was nothing else for it. The situation required absolute acquiescence, as surely as if the Kappa were holding a crossbow to his temple. Men died for refusing Barsavi far less. To refuse the Kappa's own daughter would be a particularly messy sort of suicide. If Locke balked at the Kappa's plan, he wouldn't live out the night.
I'm honored, Kappa Barsavi. So deeply honored. I hope not to disappoint you.
Disappoint me? Certainly not. Now, I know that several of my other Garistas have had their eyes on Nazca for some time, but if one of them were going to catch her eye, he'd have done it by now, eh? What a surprise when they hear the news. They'll never see this coming.
And for a wedding present, thought Locke. The angry jealousy of an unknown number of jilted suitors.
How and when should I begin, Your Honor?
Well, said Barsavi, why don't I give you a few days to think it over? I'll speak to her in the interim. Of course, for the time being, she's not to leave the floating grave. Once the Grey King is dealt with... Well, I would expect you to begin courting her in a more colourful and public fashion.
You're telling me, Locke said very carefully, I should start stealing more, then.
Consider it my challenge to you to go hand in hand with my blessing.
Barsavi smirked. Let's see if you can stay prudent while becoming more productive. I suspect you can, and I know that you wouldn't want to disappoint me or my daughter.
Certainly not, Your Honor. I'll do my very best.
Kappa Barsavi beckoned Locke forward and held his left hand out, fingers outstretched, palm down. Locke knelt before Barsavi's chair, took that hand with both of his own, and kissed the Kappa's ring, that familiar black pearl with the blood-red heart.
Kappa Barsavi,
he said with his eyes to the ground. The Kappa pulled him up again by the shoulders.
I give you my blessing, Locke Lamora. The blessing of an old man who worries for his children. I set you above many dangerous people by doing this for you. Surely it has occurred to you that my sons will inherit a dangerous office. And if they're not careful enough or hard enough for the task, well, stranger things have happened. Some day this city could be ruled by Kappa Lamora. Have you ever dreamed of this?
Truthfully, whispered Locke, I've never desired a Kappa's power because I would never want a Kappa's problems.
Well, there's that prudence again.
The Kappa smiled and gestured toward the far doors, giving Locke permission to withdraw.
A Kappa's problems are very real, but you've helped me put one of them to rest.
Locke walked back toward the entrance hall, thoughts racing. The Kappa sat on his chair behind him, staring at nothing, saying no more. The only sounds after that were Locke's own footsteps and the steady drip of blood from the gore-soaked bag around Federico's head.
8. Well, Nazca, if I were 1,000 years old and had already seen everything there is to see 6 times over, that still would have been about the last damn thing I'd have ever expected.
She was waiting for him in the little hall beyond the foyer. Once the clockwork mechanisms had sealed the door to the main hall behind them, she gave him a wry and apologetic look.
But don't you see that it would have been even stranger if I'd explained it beforehand?
The whole mess would be hard-pressed to get any god's damned weirder.
Look, please, don't take any of this the wrong way. I don't take any of it the wrong way, Locke. You're a good friend, and I feel the same way, and yet it's hard to put this right. No, it isn't. Look.
She grabbed him by the shoulders and bent down slightly to look right into his eyes.
You are a good friend, Locke. Probably the best I have. My loyal peasant. I'm extremely fond of you, but not as a possible husband. And I know that you... Locke, said Nazca, I know that the only woman with the key to that peculiar heart of yours is 1,000 miles away, and I know you'd rather be miserable over her than happy with anyone else.
Really?
Locke balled his fists.
Seems like it's pretty common fucking knowledge. I bet the Duke gets regular reports. Seems as though your father is the only person who doesn't know.
Or doesn't care.
Nazca raised her eyebrows.
Locke, it's Kappa de Pezon. It's not personal. He gives the orders and you carry them out, in most cases.
But not this one? I thought you'd be happy. At least he's making plans for the future again.
I said reasonable plans.
Nazca smiled, a real smile this time.
Come on, Pezon. Play along for a few days. We can go through the motions and put our heads together to come up with a way out of this. It's you and me we're talking about, right? The old man can't win, and he won't even know he's lost.
Right, if you say so.
Yes, I say so. Come back the day after tomorrow. We'll scheme. We'll slip this noose. Now go tend to your boys, and be careful.
Locke stepped back out into the entrance hall, and Nazca pushed the doors shut behind him. He stared back at her as the space between the black doors narrowed, gradually sealing her off from view until they slammed shut with the click of tumbling locks.
He could have sworn she winked just before the heavy black doors closed between them.
"And this is the card you picked, the Six of Spires," said Carlo, holding up a card and displaying it for the entrance hall guards.
"Fuck me," said one of them. "That's sorcery."
"Nah, it's just the old sun's a touch."
Carlo reshuffled his deck one-handed and held it out toward Locke.
"Care to give it a go, boss?"
"No thanks, Carlo. Pack up, lads. Our business here is finished for the day, so let's quit bothering the folks with the crossbows." He punctuated this with hand gestures. "Major complications. Discuss elsewhere."
"Damn, I'm hungry," said Jean, picking up the cue. "Why don't we get something at the last mistake and take it up to our rooms?"
"Yeah," said Bug. "Beer and apricot tarts."
"A combination so disgusting, I feel oddly compelled to actually try it."
Jean swatted the smallest gentleman bastard on the back of his head, then led the way as the gang made for the slender wooden path that tied the floating grave to the rest of the world. 9. Save Kappa Barsavi, who imagined that Locke's gang merely continued sitting the steps a few days of the week, even with chains in his grave, no right people of Camor knew that the gentleman bastard still worked out of the house of Perelandro. Carlo and Galdo and Bug let rooms at various points in and around the snare, moving every few months. Locke and Jean had maintained the fiction of rooming together for several years. By a great stroke of luck, though whether it was good or ill had yet to be determined, really, Jean had managed to get them the rooms on the 7th floor of the broken tower. The night was dark and full of rain, and none of the gang were particularly eager to make their way back onto the creaking exterior stairs that staggered down the north side of the tower. Hissing rain rattled the window shutters, and the wind made an eerie rising and falling sigh as it passed over the gaps and crevices in the old tower. The gentleman bastard sat on floor cushions in the light of paper lanterns and nursed the last of their beer, the pale sweet sort that most Camor natives preferred to the bitter Varari dark. The air was stuffy, but at least tolerably dry. Locke had given them the whole story over dinner.
"Well," said Galdo, "this is the damnedest damn thing that ever damned things up for us."
"I say again," said Jean, "that we should pull an early blow-off on the Don Salvara game and get ready to ride out a storm. This Grey King business is getting scary, and we can't have our attention diverted if Locke's going to be mixed up at the middle of things."
"Where do we cut ourselves off?" asked Carlo.
"We cut ourselves off now," said Jean. "Now, or after we get one more note out of the Don. No later."
"Hmm."
Locke stared down at the dregs in the bottom of his tin cup.
"We've worked hard for this one. I'm confident we can run it for another 5,000 or 10,000 crowns at least. Maybe not the 25,000 we were hoping to squeeze out of Salvara, but enough to make ourselves proud. I got the crap kicked out of me and Bug jumped off a building for this money, you know."
"And got rolled 2 miles inside a bloody barrel."
"Now, Bug," said Galdo, "it's not as though the nasty old barrel jumped you in an alley and forced you to crawl inside it. And I concur with Jean. I said it this afternoon, Locke. Even if you won't seriously consider using them, can we at least make some arrangements to get you under cover in a hurry? Maybe even out of town?"
"I still can't believe I'm hearing a Sansa council caution," Locke said with a grin. "I thought we were richer and cleverer than everyone else."
"You'll hear it again and again when there's a chance you'll get your throat slit, Locke."
Carlo picked up his brother's argument.
"I've changed my mind about the Grey King, that's for damn sure. Maybe the lone lunatic does have it over the 3,000 of us. You might be one of his targets, and if Barsavi wants you even tighter with his inner circle, it invites further trouble."
"Can we set aside talk of slitting throats just for a moment?"
Locke rose and turned toward the shuttered seaward window. He pretended to stare out of it with his hands folded behind his back.
"Who are we, after all?
I admit I was almost ready to jump into the God's damned bay when the Kappa sprang this on me.
But I've had time to think, so get this straight. We've got the old fox dead to rights. We've got him in the palms of our hands. Honestly, boys, we're so good at what we do that he's asking the Thorn of fucking Camor to marry his daughter. We're so far in the clear, it's comical.
Nonetheless, said Jean, it's a complication that could mess up our arrangements forever, not an accomplishment we can crow about.
Of course we can crow about it, Jean. I'm going to crow about it right now. Don't you see? This is nothing we don't do every day. It's a plain old gentleman bastard sort of job, only we'll have Nazca working with me to pull it off as well. We can't lose. I'm no more likely to marry her than I am to be named Duke Nicovanti's heir tomorrow morning.
Do you have a plan? Jean's eyes said he was curious but wary.
Not even remotely. I don't have the first damn clue what we're going to do, but all my best plans start just like this.
Locke tipped the last of his beer down his throat and tossed the tin cup against the wall.
I've had my beer and I've had my apricot tarts, and I say the hell with them both, Grey King and Kappa Barsavi. Nobody's going to scare us out of our Don Salvara game, and nobody's going to hitch me and Nazca against our will. We'll do what we always do, wait for an opening, take it, and fucking well win.
Well... Jean sighed. Will you at least let us take a few precautions? And will you watch yourself coming and going?
Naturally, Jean, naturally. You grab us some places on likely ships. Spend whatever you have to. I don't care where they're going as long as it's not Jerem. We can lose ourselves anywhere for a few weeks and creep back when we please. Carlo, Galdo, you get out to the Viscount's gate tomorrow. Leave some considerations for the boys in yellow so we can get out of the city at an awkward hour if we need to. Don't be shy with the silver and gold.
What can I do?
Asked Bug. You can watch our backs. Keep your eyes wide open. Skulk around the temple. Spot me anyone out of place, anyone who lingers too long. If anyone is trying to keep an eye on us, I guarantee we will go to ground and vanish like piss into the ocean. Until then... Trust me, I promise to do most of my moving around as Lucas Fairwhite for the next few days. I can swap in some cheaper disguises, too.
Then I suppose that's that, Jean said quietly.
Jean, I can be your garista, or I can just be the fellow who buys beer and tarts when everyone else mysteriously misplaces their purses.
Locke eyed the gathering with an exaggerated scowl. I can't be both. It's one or the other.
I'm nervous, said Jean, because I don't like having as little information as I fear we do. I share Nazca's suspicions. The Grey King has something up his sleeves, something we don't understand. Our game is very delicate and our situation is very fluid.
I know, but I follow my gut, and my gut says that we meet this one head on with smiles on our faces.
Look, said Locke. The more we do this, the more I learn about what I think Chains was really training us for. And this is it. He wasn't training us for a calm and orderly world where we could pick and choose when we needed to be clever. He was training us for a situation that was fucked up on all sides. Well, we're in it, and I say we're equal to it. I don't need to be reminded that we're up to our heads in dark water. I just want you boys to remember that we're the gods' damned sharks.
"Right on!" cried Bug. "I knew there was a reason I let you lead this gang!"
"Well, I can't argue with the manifest wisdom of the boy that jumps off temple roofs, but I trust my points are noted," said Jean.
"Very noted," said Locke. "Received, recognized, and duly considered with the utmost gravity. Sealed, notarized, and firmly imprinted upon my rational essence."
Gods, you really are cheerful about this, aren't you? You only play vocabulary games when you feel genuinely sunny about the world.
Jean sighed, but couldn't keep the slightest hint of a smile from tugging at the corners of his lips.
If you do end up in danger, Locke, said Carlo,
You must understand that we will ignore the orders of our garista and will bludgeon our friend on the back of his thick skull and smuggle him out of Camor in a box. I have just the bludgeon for the job.
And I have a box, said Galdo. Been hoping for an excuse to use it for years, really.
Also noted, said Locke, with thanks. But by the grace of the crooked warden, I choose to trust us. I choose to trust Chain's judgment. I choose to keep doing what we do best. Tomorrow, I've got some work to do as Fairwhite, and then I'll go see Nazca again the day after. The Kappa will be expecting it, and I'm sure she'll have some ideas of her own by then. Locke thought once again of his last glimpse of her, that wink as the two great doors of dark wood slammed shut between them. Maintaining her father's secrets was Nazca's entire life. Did it mean something for her to have one of her own that she could keep from him? Interlude. The Boy Who Cried for a Corpse. 1. Father Chains gave Locke no respite from his education on the day after the visit to the last mistake. With his head still pounding from a brown sugar rum headache, Locke began to learn about the priesthood of Perelandro and the priesthood of the Benefactor. There were hand signs and ritual intonations, methods of greeting and meanings behind robe decorations. On his fourth day in Chain's care, Locke began to sit the steps as one of the initiates of Perelandro, clad in white and trying to look suitably humble and pathetic. As the weeks passed, the breadth of Chain's instruction expanded. Locke did 2 hours of reading and scribing each day. His pen scratchings grew smoother step by halting step until the Sansa brothers announced that he no longer wrote, "Like a dog with an arrow in its brain." Locke was moved enough by their praise to dust their sleeping palates with red pepper. The Sansas were distraught when their attempted retaliation was foiled by the utter paranoia Locke still carried with him from his experiences in Shade's Hill and the Catchfire Plague. It was simply impossible to sneak up on him or catch him sleeping.
"The brothers have never before met their match in mischief," said Chains, as he and Locke sat the steps one particularly slow day. "Now they're wary of you. When they start coming to you for advice, well, that's when you'll know that you have them tamed."
Locke had smiled and said nothing. Just that morning, Carlo had offered to give Locke extra help with his sums if the smallest gentleman bastard would only tell the twins how he kept spotting their little booby traps and rendering them harmless. Locke revealed precious few of his survival tricks, but he did accept the help of both Sansas in his study of arithmetic. His only reward for each accomplishment was a more complex problem from Chains. At the same time, he began his education in spoken Vardran. Chains would issue simple commands in the language, and once Locke was reasonably familiar with the tongue, Chains often forbade the three boys to speak anything else for hours at a time. Even their dinner conversation was conducted in the harsh and illogical language of the North. To Locke, it often seemed impossible to say anything in Vardran that didn't sound angry.
"You won't hear this among the right people much, but you'll hear it on the docks and among the merchants, that's for damn sure," said Chains. "And when you hear someone speaking it, don't ever let on that you know it, unless you absolutely have to. You'd be surprised how arrogant some of those northern types are when it comes to their speech. Just play dumb, and you never know what they might let slip."
There was more instruction in the culinary arts. Chains had Locke slaving away at the cooking hearth every other night, with Carlo and Galdo vigorously henpecking him in tandem.
"This is Vice Aloapona, the fifth beautiful art of Camor," said Chains. "Guild chefs learn all 8 styles better than they learn the uses of their own cocks, but you'll just get the basics for now. Mind you, our basics piss on everyone else's best. Only Carthane and Emberlane come close. Most Vardrans wouldn't know fine cuisine from rat shit in lamp oil. Now, This is pinch of gold pepper, and this is Gerishti olive oil, and just behind them I keep dried cinnamon lemon rind. Locke stewed octopus and boiled potatoes. He sliced pears and apples and alchemical hybrid fruit that oozed honey-scented liquor. He spiced and seasoned and bit his tongue in furious concentration. He was frequently the architect of gruesome messes that were hauled out behind the temple and fed to the goat. But as he improved at everything else required of him, he improved steadily at the hearth. Soon the Sansas ceased to tease him and began to trust him as an assistant with their own delicate creations. One night, about half a year after his arrival at the House of Perelandro, Locke and the Sansas collaborated on a stuffed platter of infant sharks. This was vice entemere, the first beautiful art, the cuisine of sea creatures. Carlo gutted the soft-skinned little sharks and stuffed them with red and yellow peppers, which had in turn been stuffed with sausage and blood cheese by Locke. The tiny staring eyes of the creatures were replaced with black olives. Once the little teeth were plucked out, their mouths were stuffed with glazed carrots and rice, and their fins and tails were cut off to be boiled in soup. "Ah," said Chains, when the elaborate meal was settling in four appreciative gullets, "now that was genuinely excellent, boys. But while you're cleaning up and scouring the dishes, I only want to hear you speaking Vadran." And so it went. Locke was schooled further in the art of setting a table and waiting on individuals of high station. He learned how to hold out a chair and how to pour tea and wine. He and the Sansas conducted elaborate dinner-table rituals with the gravity of physicers cutting open a patient. There were lessons in clothing, the tying of cravats, the buckling of shoes, the wearing of expensive affectations such as hose. In fact, there was a dizzying variety of instruction in virtually every sphere of human accomplishment except thievery. As the first anniversary of Locke's arrival at the temple loomed, that changed. "I owe some favours, boys," said Chains one night as they all hunkered down in the lifeless rooftop garden. This was where he preferred to discuss all the weightier matters of their life together, at least when it wasn't raining. "Favours I can't put off when certain people come calling."
"Like the kappa?" asked Locke.
"Not this time." Chains took a long drag on his habitual after-dinner smoke. "This time I owe the black alchemists. You know about them, right?"
Carlo and Galdo nodded, but hesitantly. Locke shook his head.
"Well," said Chains, "there's a right and proper guild of alchemists, but they're very choosy about the sort of person they let in, and the sort of work they let them do. Black alchemists are sort of the reason the guild has such strict rules. They do business in false shop fronts with people like us, drugs, poisons, what have you. The kappa owns them, same as he owns us, but nobody really leans on them directly. They're, not the sort of people you want to upset. Jessaline Dorbar is probably the best of the lot. I had occasion to get poisoned once. She took care of it for me, so I owe her, and she's finally called in the favor. What she wants is a corpse."
"Beggar's barrow," said Carlo. "And a shovel," said Galdo.
"No, she needs a fresh corpse, still warm and juicy, as it were. See, the guilds of alchemists and physicers are entitled to a certain number of fresh corpses each year by ducal charter. Straight off the gallows for cutting open and poking around. The black alchemists don't receive any such courtesy, and Jessaline has some theories she wants to put to the test. So I've decided you boys are going to work together on your first real job. I want you to find a corpse, fresher than morning bread. Get your hands on it without attracting undue attention, and bring it here so I can hand it off to Jessaline."
"Steal a corpse? This won't be any fun," said Galdo.
"Think of it as a valuable test of your skills,"
said Chains.
"Are we likely to steal many corpses in the future?" asked Carlo.
"It's not a test of your corpse-plucking abilities, you cheeky little nitwit," Chains said amiably. "I mean to see how you all work together on something more serious than our dinner. I'll consider setting you up with anything you ask for, but I'm not giving you hints. You get to figure this one out on your own."
"Anything we ask for?" said Locke.
"Within reason," said Chains. "And let me emphasize that you can't make the corpse yourself. You have to find it honestly dead by someone else's doing."
So forceful was Chains' voice when he said this that the Sansa brothers stared warily at Locke for a few seconds, then gave each other a look with eyebrows arched.
"When?" said Locke. "Does this lady want it by?"
"She'd be very pleased to have it in the next week or so."
Locke nodded, then stared down at his hands for a few seconds.
"Carlo, Galdo," he said, "will you sit the steps tomorrow so I can think about this?"
"Yes," they said without hesitation, and Father Chains didn't miss the note of hope in their voices. He would remember that moment ever after. The night the Sansas conceded that Locke would be the brains of their operation. The night they were relieved to have him as the brains of their operation.
"Honestly dead," said Locke, "and not killed by us, and not even stiff yet. Right. I know we can do it. It'll be easy. I just don't know why or how yet."
"Your confidence heartens me," said Chains. "But I want you to remember that you're on a very short leash. If a tavern should happen to burn down or a riot should happen to break out around you, I'll throw you off this roof with lead ingots tied around your neck."
Carlo and Galdo stared at Locke once again.
"Short leash, right. But don't worry," said Locke. "I'm not as reckless as I was. You know, when I was little."
2. The next day, Locke walked the length of the temple district on his own for the very first time, hooded in a clean white robe of Perelandro's order with silvery embroidery on the sleeves, waist high to virtually everyone around him. He was astonished at the courtesy given to the robe, a courtesy he clearly understood that in many cases only partially devolved on the poor fool wearing the robe. Most Camorri regarded the Order of Perelandro with a mixture of cynicism and guilty pity. The unabashed charity of the god and his priesthood just didn't speak to the rough heart of the city's character. Yet the reputation of Father Chains as a colourful freak of piety paid certain dividends. Men who surely joked about the simpering of the beggar god's white-robed priests with their friends nonetheless threw coins into Chains' kettle, eyes averted when they passed his temple. It turned out they also let a little robed initiate pass on the street without harassment. Groups parted fluidly and merchants nodded almost politely as Locke went on his way. For the first time he learned what a powerful thrill it was to go about in public in an effective disguise. The sun was creeping upward toward noon. The crowds were thick and the city was alive with the echoes and murmurs of its masses. Locke padded intently to the southwest corner of the temple district, where a glass catbridge arched across the canal to the island of the old citadel. Catbridges were another legacy of the Eldren who'd ruled before the coming of men. Narrow glass arches no wider than an ordinary man's hips, arranged in pairs over most of Camor's canals and at several places along the Angevine River. Although they looked smooth, their glimmering surfaces were as rough as shark's hide leather. For those with a reasonable measure of agility and confidence, they provided the only convenient means of crossing water at many points. Traffic was always one-directional over each catbridge. Ducal decree clearly stated that anyone going the wrong direction could be shoved off by those with the right of way. As he scuttled across this bridge, pondering furiously, Locke recalled some of the history lessons Chains had drilled into him. The old citadel district had once been the home of the Dukes of Camor, centuries earlier, when all the city-states claimed by the Therin people had knelt to a single throne in the imperial city of Therim Pell.
That line of Komori nobility, in superstitious dread of the perfectly good glass towers left behind by the Eldrin, had erected a massive stone palace in the heart of southern Komor. When one of Nicovante's great-great predecessors, on finer points of city lore such as this, Locke's undeniably prodigious knowledge dissolved in a haze of total indifference, took up residence in the silver glass tower called Raven's Reach, the old family fortress had become the Palace of Patience, the heart of Komor's municipal justice such as it was. The Yellow Jackets and their officers were headquartered there, as were the Duke's magistrates, 12 men and women who presided over their cases in scarlet robes and velvet masks, their true identities never to be revealed to the general public. Each was named for one of the months of the year, Justice Parthis, Justice Festal, Justice Aurim, and so forth, though each one passed judgment year-round. And there were dungeons, and there were the gallows on the Black Bridge that led to the palace gates, and there were other things. While the secret peace had greatly reduced the number of people who took the short, sharp drop off the Black Bridge, and didn't Duke Nicovante love to publicly pin that on his own magnanimity, the Duke's servants had devised other punishments that were spectacular in their cruel cleverness, if technically non-lethal. The palace was a great square heap of pitted black and grey stone, 10 stories high. The huge bricks that formed its walls had been arranged into simple mosaics that had now weathered to a ghostly state. The rows of high arched windows that decorated every other level of the tower were stained glass, with black and red designs predominating. At night a light would burn ominously behind each one, dim red eyes in the darkness, staring out in all directions. Those windows were never dark. The intended message was clear. There were 4 open-topped circular towers jutting out from each corner of the palace, seemingly hanging in air from the 6th or 7th level up. On the sides of these hung black iron crow cages, in which prisoners singled out for special mistreatment would be aired out for a few hours or even a few days, with their feet dangling. Yet even these were seats in paradise compared to the spider cages, a spectacle that became visible to Locke between the backs and shoulders of adults as he stepped off the catbridge and into the crowds of the old citadel. From the southeastern tower of the Palace of Patience were dangled 6 cages on long steel chains, swaying gently in the wind like little spiders on cords of silk. 2 of these were moving, one slowly headed up and the other rapidly descending. Prisoners condemned to the spider cages were not to be allowed a moment's peace, so other prisoners condemned to hard labour would toil at the huge capstans atop the tower, working in shifts around the clock until a subject in a cage was deemed to be sufficiently unhinged and contrite. Lurching and creaking and open to the elements on all sides, the cages would go up and down ceaselessly. At night one could frequently hear the occupants pleading and screaming, even from a district or two away. The old citadel wasn't a very cosmopolitan district. Outside the Palace of Patience there were canal docks and stables reserved for the Yellow Jackets, offices for the Duke's tax collectors and scribes and other functionaries, and seedy little coffee houses where freelance solicitors and law scribes would try to drum up work from the families and friends of those being held in the palace. A few pawn shops and other businesses clung tenaciously to the northern part of the island, but for the most part they were crowded out by the grimmer business of the Duke's government. The district's other major landmark was the Black Bridge that spanned the wide canal between Old Citadel and the Mara Camorazza. A tall arch of black human-set stone adorned with red lamps that were fixed up with ceremonial black shrouds that could be lowered with a few tugs on a rope. The hangings were conducted from a wooden platform that jutted off the bridge's south side. Supposedly, the unquiet shades of the condemned would be carried out to sea if they died over running water. Some thought that they would then be incarnated in the bodies of sharks, which explained why Komor Bay had such a problem with the creatures, and the idea was not entirely scoffed at. As far as most Komori were concerned, turnabout was fair play. Locke stared at the Black Bridge for a good long while, exercising that capacity for conniving that chains had so forcefully repressed for many long months.
He was far too young for much self-analysis, but the process of scheming gave him real pleasure, like a little ball of tingling warmth in the pit of his stomach. He had no name for what he was doing, but in the collision of his whirling thoughts a plan began to form, and the more he thought on it, the more pleased he became with himself. It was a fine thing that his white hood concealed his face from most passers-by, lest anyone should see an initiate of Perelandro staring fixedly at a gallows and grinning wildly. 3.
"I need the names of any men who are going to hang in the next week or two," said Locke, as he and Chains set the temple steps the next day.
"If you were enterprising," said Chains, "and you most certainly are, you could get them yourself and leave your poor fat old master in peace."
"I would, but I need someone else to do it. It won't work if I'm seen around the Palace of Patience before the hangings."
"What won't work?"
"The plan."
"Oh-ho! Nervy little Shades Hill purse clutcher, thinking you can keep me in the dark? What plan?"
"The plan to steal a corpse."
"Ahem. Anything else you'd like to tell me about it?"
"It's brilliant."
A passerby tossed something into the kettle. Locke bowed and Chains waved his hands in the man's general direction, his restraints clattering, and yelled,
50 years of health to you and your children, and the blessings of the Lord of the Overlooked!"
"It would have been 100 years, muttered Chains when the man had passed, but that sounded like a clipped half-copper.
"Now, your brilliant plan. I know you've had audacious plans, but I'm not entirely sure you've had a brilliant one yet."
"This is the one, then. Honest, but I need those names."
"If it's so, it's so."
Chains leaned backward and stretched, grunting in satisfaction as his back creaked and popped.
"I'll get them for you tonight."
"And I'll need some money."
"Ah, well, I expected that. Take what you need from the vault and mark it on the ledger. Screw around with it, though."
"I know. Lead ingots. Screaming. Death."
"Something like that.
You're a little on the small side, but I suppose Jessalyn might learn a thing or two from your corpse anyway." 4. Penance Day was the traditional day for hangings in Camor. Each week a sullen handful of prisoners would be trotted out from the Palace of Patience, priests and guards surrounding them. Noon was the hour of the drop. At the 8th hour of the morning, when the functionaries in the courtyard of the palace threw open their wooden shutters and settled in for a long day of saying, "Fuck off in the name of the Duke," to all comers, 3 robed initiates of Perelandro wheeled a narrow wooden pull-cart into the courtyard. The smallest of the 3 made his way over to the first available clerk. His thin little face barely topped the forward edge of the clerk's booth.
"Well, this is odd," said the clerk,
a woman of late middle years, shaped something like a bag of potatoes, but perhaps not quite as warm or sympathetic.
"Help you with something?"
"There's a man being hanged," said Locke. "Noon today."
"You don't say. Here I thought it was a state secret."
"His name's Antrim. Antrim One Hand, they call him. He's got..."
"One hand? Yes, he drops today. Fire setting, theft, dealing with slavers. Charming man."
"I was going to say that he had a wife," said Locke. "She has business. About him."
"Look, the time for appeals is past. Saris, Festal, and Tathris sealed the death warrant. Antrim One Hand belongs to Morgante now, and then to Azaguia. Not even one of the beggar god's cute little sprats can help him at this point."
"I know," said Locke. "I don't want him spared. His wife doesn't care if he gets hanged. I'm here about the body."
"Really?"
Genuine curiosity flickered in the clerk's eyes for the first time.
"Now that is odd. What about the body?"
"His wife knows he deserves to get hanged, but she wants him to get a fairer chance. You know, with the Lady of the Long Silence.
So she's paid for us to take the body and put it in our temple, so we can burn candles and pray for intercession in Perelandro's name for 3 days and nights. We'll bury him after that.
Well, no, said the clerk. The corpses usually get cut down after an hour and tossed into holes on the beggar's barrow. More than they deserve, but it's tidy. We don't usually just go handing them out to anyone who wants one.
I know. My master cannot see or leave our temple, or else he'd be here to explain himself. But where all he has? I'm supposed to say that he knows this is making trouble for you.
Locke's little hand appeared over the edge of the booth, and when it withdrew, a small leather purse was sitting on the clerk's counting board.
That's very considerate of him. We all know how devoted old Father Chains is.
The clerk swept the purse behind her counter and gave it a shake. It jingled, and she grunted.
Still a bit of a problem, though.
My master would be grateful for any help you could give us.
Another purse appeared on the counter, and the clerk actually broke a smile.
It's within the realm of possibility, she said. Not quite certain yet, of course.
Locke conjured a third purse, and the clerk nodded.
I'll speak to the masters of the ropes, little one.
We even brought our own cart, said Locke. We don't want to be any trouble.
I'm sure you won't be.
Her demeanour softened for just a moment.
I didn't mean ill by what I said about the beggar god boy. I didn't take it ill, madam. After all, it's what we do.
He favoured her with what he thought was his most endearing little grin.
Did you not give me what I asked for, because I begged, simply out of the goodness of your own heart, with no coin involved?
Why, of course I did.
She actually winked at him.
20 years of health to you and your children,
Locke said, bowing and briefly disappearing beneath the lip of her counter,
and the blessings of the Lord of the Overlooked.
5. It was a short, neat hanging. The Duke's masters of the ropes were nothing if not well practised at their trade. It wasn't the first execution Locke had ever seen, nor would it be the last. He and the Sansa brothers even had a chance to make all the proper reverential gestures when one of the condemned begged for Perelandro's blessings at the last minute. Traffic across the Black Bridge was halted for executions. A small crowd of guards, spectators, and priests milled about afterward as the requisite hour passed. The corpses twisted in the breeze beneath them, ropes creaking. Locke and the Sansas stood off to the side respectfully with their little cart. Eventually, yellow jackets began to haul the bodies up one by one under the watchful eyes of several priests of Azaguia. The corpses were carefully set down in an open dray pulled by 2 black horses draped in the black and silver of the Death Goddess Order. The last corpse to be drawn up was that of a wiry man with a long beard and a shaved head. His left hand ended in a puckered red stump. 4 yellow jackets carried this body over to the cart where the boys waited. A priestess of Azaguia accompanied them. Locke felt a chill run up and down his spine when that inscrutable silver mesh mask tilted down toward him.
"Little brothers of Perelandro," said the priestess, "what intercession would you plead for on behalf of this man?"
Her voice was that of a very young woman, perhaps no more than 15 or 16. If anything, that only enhanced her eeriness in Locke's eyes, and he found his throat suddenly dry.
"We plead for whatever will be given," said Carlo. "The will of the 12 is not ours to presume," continued Galdo.
The priestess inclined her head very slightly.
"I'm told this man's widow requested an interment in the house of Perelandro before burial."
"Apparently she thought he might need it, begging pardon," said Carlo.
"It's not without precedent, but it is far more usual for the aggrieved to seek our intercession with the lady."
"Our master," managed Locke, "made a solemn promise to the poor woman that we would give our care. Surely we mean no ill toward you or the lady most fair, if we must keep our word."
"Of course, I did not mean to suggest that you had done anything wrong. The lady will weigh him in the end, whatever is said and done before the vessel is entombed."
She gestured, and the yellow jackets set the corpse down on the cart. One of them unfurled a cheap cotton shroud and swung it over Antrim's body, leaving only the top of his head uncovered.
"Blessings of the Lady of the Long Silence to you and your master."
"Blessings of the Lord of the Overlooked," said Locke,
as he and the Sansas bowed in unison from the waist. A braided silver cord around the priestess' neck marked her as more than a simple initiate like themselves.
"To you and your brothers and sisters."
The Sansa brothers each took one pole at the front of the cart, and Locke took up the rear, to push and to keep the load balanced. He was instantly sorry that he'd taken this spot. The hanging had filled the man's breeches with his own shit, and the smell was rising. Gritting his teeth, he called out,
"To the house of Perelandro, with all dignity!"
Plodding slowly, the Sansas pulled the cart down the western side of the Black Bridge, and then turned north to head for the wide, low bridge that led to the shifting market's eastern district. It was a slightly roundabout way home, but not at all suspicious, at least until the three white-robed boys were well away from anyone who'd seen them leave the hanging. Moving with a bit more haste, and enjoying the added deference the dead man was bringing them, save only for Locke, who was still effectively downwind of the poor fellow's last futile act in life, they turned left and headed for the bridges to the Fauna. Once there, they pressed south and crossed into the Videnza district, a relatively clean and spacious island well patrolled by yellow jackets. At the heart of the Videnza was a market square of merchant artisans, recognized names who disdained the churning chaos of the shifting market. They operated from the first floors of their fine old sagging houses, which were always freshly mortared and whitewashed over their post and timber frames. The district's tiled roofs, by tradition, were glazed in brightly irregular colours. Blue and purple and red and green, they teased the eyes and gleamed like glass under the glare of the sun. At the northern entrance to the square, Carlo darted away from the cart and vanished into the crowd. Locke came up from the rear, muttering prayers of gratitude, to take his place. So arrayed, they hauled their odd cargo toward the shop of Ambrosine Strollo, first lady of Camor's chandlers, furnisher to the Duke himself.
"If there's a niggardly speck of genuine fellowship in Camor," Chains had once said, "one little place where Perelandro's name isn't spoken with a sort of sorry contempt, it's the Videnza. Merchants are a miserly lot, and craftsfolk are pressed with care. However, those that turn a very pretty profit plying their chosen trade are likely to be somewhat happy. They get the best of all worlds for common folk, assuming our lot doesn't fuck with them."
Locke was impressed with the response he and Galdo received as they drew the cart up in front of Madame Strollo's four-story home. Here the merchants and customers alike bowed their heads as the corpse passed. Many of them even made the wordless gesture of benediction in the name of the 12, touching first their eyes with both hands, and then their lips, and finally their hearts.
"My dears," said Madame Strollo, "what an honour, and what an unusual errand you must be on."
She was a slender woman getting well on in years, a sort of cosmic opposite to the clerk Locke had dealt with that morning. Strollo exuded attentive deference. She behaved as though the two little red-faced initiates, sweating heavily under their robes, were full priests of a more powerful order. If she could smell the mess in Antrim's breeches, she refrained from saying so. She sat at the street-side window of her shop, under a heavy wooden awning that folded down at night to seal the place tight against mischief. The window was perhaps 10 feet wide and half as high, and Madame Strollo was surrounded by candles, stacked layer upon layer, tier upon tier, like the houses and towers of a fantastical wax city. Alchemical globes had largely replaced the cheap taper as the light source of choice for nobility and lobility alike. The few remaining master chandlers fought back by mingling ever more lovely scents in their creations. Additionally, there was the ceremonial need of Camor's temples and believers, a need that cold glass light was generally considered inadequate to meet.
"We're interring this man," said Locke, "for 3 days and nights before his burial. My master needs new candles for the ceremony."
Old chains, you mean? Poor dear man. Let's see. You'll want lavender for cleanliness, and autumn blood flower for the blessing, and sulphur roses for the lady most fair?
Please, said Locke, pulling out a humble leather purse that jingled with silver. And some votives without scent, half a dozen of all four kinds.
Madame Strollo carefully selected the candles and wrapped them in waxed burlap.
A gift of the house, she muttered when Locke began to open his mouth, and perhaps I put a few more than half a dozen of each in the packet.
Locke tried to argue with her for form's sake, but the old woman grew conveniently deaf for a few crucial seconds as she finished wrapping her goods. Locke paid 3 solons out of his purse, taking care to let her see that there were a dozen more nestled therein, and wished Madame Strollo a full 100 years of health for herself and her children in the name of the Lord of the Overlooked as he backed away. He set the package of candles on the cart, tucking it just under the blanket beside Antrim's glassy, staring eyes. No sooner had he turned around to resume his place next to Galdo when a taller boy dressed in ragged, dirty clothes walked right into him, sending him tumbling onto his back.
"Oh!" said the boy, who happened to be Carlo Sanza. "A 1,000 pardons! I'm so clumsy! Here, let me help you up!"
He grabbed Locke's outstretched hand and yanked the smaller boy back to his feet.
12 gods! An initiate! Forgive me, forgive me! I simply did not see you standing there!"
Clucking with concern, he brushed dirt from Locke's white robe.
"Are you well?" "I am, I am. Forgive my clumsiness. I meant no insult." "None is taken. Thank you for helping me back up."
With that, Carlo gave a mock bow and ran off into the crowd. In just a few seconds he was lost to sight. Locke made a show of dusting himself off while he slowly counted to 30 inside his head. At 31 he sat down suddenly beside the cart, put his hooded head in his hands, and began to sniffle. Just a few seconds later he was sobbing loudly. Responding to the cue, Galdo came over and knelt beside him, placing one hand on his shoulder.
"Boys," said Ambrosine Strollo, "boys, what's the matter? Are you hurt? Did that oaf jar something?"
Galdo made a show of muttering into Locke's ear. Locke muttered back, and Galdo fell backward onto his own posterior. He reached up and tugged at his hood in an excellent imitation of frustration, and his eyes were wide.
"No, Madame Strollo," he said. "It's worse than that."
"Worse? What do you mean? What's the trouble?"
"It's silver,"
Locke burbled, looking up to let her see the tears pouring down his cheeks and the artful curl of his lips.
"He took my purse, picked my pocket." "It was payment," said Galdo, "from this man's widow, not just for the candles, but for his interment, our blessings, and his funeral. We were to bring it back to Father Chains along with the..."
"With the body," Locke burst out. "I failed him."
12, the old lady muttered. "That incredible little bastard."
Leaning out over the counter of her shop window, she hollered in a voice of surprising strength,
"Thief! Stop, thief!"
As Locke buried his head in his hands once again, she turned her head upward and shouted,
"Lucrezia!"
"Yes, grandmamma," came a voice from an open window. "What's this about a thief?"
"Rouse your brothers, child. Get them down here now and tell them to bring their sticks."
She turned to regard Locke and Galdo.
"Don't cry, my dear boys, don't cry. We'll make this right somehow."
"What's this about a thief?"
A lanky sergeant of the watch ran up, truncheon out, mustard yellow coat flapping behind him, and 2 other yellow jackets at his heels.
"A fine constable you are, Vidric, to let those little coat-charmer bastards from the cauldron sneak in and rob customers right in front of my shop."
"What, here? Them?"
The watch sergeant took in the distraught boys, the furious old woman, and the covered corpse. His eyebrows attempted to leap straight up off his forehead.
"And that
I say, that man is dead.
Of course he's dead, Thimblebrains. These boys are taking him to the house of Perelandro for blessings and a funeral. That little cutpurse just stole the bag with his widow's payment for it all.
Someone robbed the initiates of Perelandro? The boys who helped that blind priest?
A florid man with an overachieving belly and an entire squad of spare chins wobbled up, with a walking stick in one hand and a wicked-looking hatchet in the other.
Pissant rat-fucker bastards! Such an infamy! In the Videnza, in broad light of day!
I'm sorry, Locke sobbed. I'm so sorry, I didn't realize. I should have held it tighter. He was so quick!
Nonsense, boy! It was hardly your fault, said Madame Strollo.
The watch sergeant began blowing his whistle. The fat man with the walking stick continued to spit vitriol, and a pair of young men appeared around the corner of the Strollo house, carrying curved truncheons shod with brass. There was more rapid shouting until they determined that their grandmother was unhurt. When they discovered the reason for her summons, they too began uttering threats and curses and promises of vengeance.
"Here," said Madame Strollo, "here, boys, the candles will be my gift. This sort of thing doesn't happen in the Videnza. We won't stand for it."
She set the three solons Locke had given her back atop her counter.
"How much was in the purse?"
15 solons before we paid you," said Galdo. "So 12 got stolen. Chains is going to throw us out of the order."
"Don't be foolish," said Madame Strollo.
She added 2 more coins to the pile as the crowd around her shop began to swell.
"Hells yes!" cried the fat man. "We can't let that little devil dishonor us like this. Madame Strollo, how much are you giving? I'll give more."
"Gods take you, you selfish old pig. This isn't about showing me up."
"I'll give you a basket of oranges," said one of the women in the crowd, "for you and for the eyeless priest."
"I have a solon I can give,"
said another merchant, pressing forward with the coin in his hand.
"Vidric!"
Madame Strollo turned from her argument with her florid neighbour.
"Vidric, this is your fault. You owe these initiates some copper at the very least."
"My fault? Now look here."
"No, you look here. When they speak of the Videnza now, they'll say, 'Ah, that's where they rob priests, isn't it? For the 12's sake, just like Catchfire, or worse.'"
She spat.
"You give something to make amends, or I'll harp on your captain, and you'll end up rowing a shipboat until your hair turns grey and your teeth come out at the roots."
Grimacing, the watch sergeant stepped forward and reached for his purse. But there was already a tight press around the two boys. They were helped to their feet, and Locke received too many comforting pats on the back to count. They were plied with coins, fruit, and small gifts. One merchant tossed his more valuable coins into a coat pocket and handed over his purse. Locke and Galdo adopted convincing expressions of bewilderment and surprise. As each gift was handed over to them, they protested as best they could, for form's sake. 6. It was the 4th hour of the afternoon before the body of Antrim One Hand was safely stashed in the damp sanctuary of the House of Perelandro. The 3 white-robed boys, for Carlo had rejoined them safely at the edge of the temple district, padded down the steps and took their seats beside Father Chains, who sat in his usual spot with one burly arm thrown over the rim of his copper kettle.
"So," he said, "boys, is Jessalyn going to be sorry she saved my life?"
"Not at all," said Locke. "It's a great corpse," said Carlo. "Smells a bit," said Galdo. "Other than that," said Carlo, "it's a fantastic corpse." "Hanged at noon," said Locke. "Still fresh."
"I'm very pleased. Very, very pleased. But I really must ask, why the hell have men and women been throwing money in my kettle for the past 30 minutes, telling me they're sorry for what happened in the Videnza?"
"It's because they're sorry for what happened in the Videnza," said Galdo. It wasn't a burning tavern, benefactor's own truth, said Locke.
What, said Chains, speaking slowly as though to a misbehaving pet, did you boys do with the corpse before you stashed it in the temple?
Made money.
Locke tossed the merchant's donated purse into the kettle, where it hit with a heavy clang.
23 solons 3, to be precise. And a basket of oranges, said Carlo. Plus a packet of candles, added Galdo. 2 loaves of black pepper bread, a wax carton of small beer, and some glow globes.
Chains was silent for a moment, and then he actually peeked down into the kettle, pretending to readjust his blindfold by raising it just a bit at the bottom. Carlo and Galdo began to confide the roughest outline of the scheme Locke had prepared and executed with their help, giggling as they did so.
"Bugger me bloody with a boat hook," Chains said when they finished. "I don't recall telling you that your leash was slipped enough for fucking street theatre, Locke."
"We had to get our money back somehow," said Locke. "Cost us 15 silvers to get the body from the Palace of Patience. Now we're up some, plus candles and bread and beer."
"Oranges," said Carlo. "Glow globes," said Galdo. "Don't forget those. They're pretty."
"Crooked Warden," said Chains. "Just this morning I was suffering from the delusion that I was handing out the educations here."
They sat in companionable silence for a few moments after that, while the sun settled into its downward arc in the west, and long shadows began to creep across the face of the city.
"Well, what the hell?"
Chains rattled his manacles a few times to keep up his circulation.
"I'll take back what I gave you to spend. Of the extra, Carlo, you and Galdo can have a silver apiece to do as you please. Locke, you can have the rest to put toward your dues. It was fairly stolen."
At that moment, a well-dressed man in a forest-green coat and a four-cornered hat walked up to the temple steps. He threw a handful of coins into the kettle. They sounded like mingled silver and copper as they clattered. The man tipped his hat to the 3 boys and said,
"I'm from the Videnza. I want you to know that I'm furious about what happened."
100 years of health for you and your children, said Locke, and the blessings of the Lord of the Overlooked.